Welcome to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Claire Noon. Claire has seen a lot in her 30 years, largely because she's always been compelled to try and do what she can to help others. In college, she was assisting the war widows of Bosnia and Serbia. And today, she's in the refugee detention camps in Texas, helping families and their children from Central America. I started our interview by asking what motivates her.
I have always felt a very strong sense of responsibility for my fellow man. And I've never really seen the kind of boundaries that we like to draw between each other. I've really identified that any children are all of our children. And so that's really why I went to law school. I was living and working in Bosnia with genocide survivors, helping them develop their economic sustainability, really thinking I was doing, you know, good work, which I was. But one day we were walking down the street and a woman that I was with kind of bowed her head and looked away. And I looked across the street and I said, "Who was that? Why did you just react like that?" And she said, "Well, that's the man that killed my husband." And so at that moment, I was like, wait, okay. Justice is a crucially important element to every kind of healing, every kind of growth, every time of reconstruction after wars. So the laws that we create and the justice that we hold each other to is, for me, the fiber that holds together society. And so I applied to law school from Bosnia, went to University of Denver.
It was really Bosnia, your experience as a student in Bosnia.
Yeah, so I had done a study abroad in Bosnia, which was kind of a small group of eight where we lived in Croatia, lived in Bosnia, lived in Serbia, and did kind of post-war transformation study. And through that, you know, you live with the Croats and they say, "Oh, don't trust the Serbs or the Bosnians." And then you live with the Serbs and they say, "Don't trust the Croats or the Bosnians." And you kind of go around, and I got a really great perspective on kind of how we all are the same and we all are very fearful. But at the end of the day, there's no one that's inherently evil and no one that's inherently good. So the kind of relativism of humanity really came through. And then I went back to college, did my thesis on Bosnian electoral politics, and then came back as a peace fellow. And that's when I actually worked intensively with genocide survivors. So that, I mean, was kind of just the most recent iteration of my work. But in college, I did a border politics study where we went and worked with No More Deaths in the area near Tucson where they leave water out for migrants.
Right.
Worked at the camp where in the middle of the desert where they bandage feet for people. And we went to ICE headquarters and watched the kind of surveillance that they do. So I've been really interested in how we treat vulnerable people and how people kind of fall into place in this world.
Where did that come from? Your motivation to focus on those less fortunate?
I mean, I'd like to say, I mean, I grew up with a family that was always very active in providing things for community. But there is something just in me where I feel when I'm doing that kind of work, I almost feel like a river of energy is flowing through me and pulling me forward. Like it's the closest to religious experience I've had where I truly feel like, oh, this is just, I'm just following some great current, and I've been pulled in different directions with that current. I've done Native American rights, working on the Bears Ears case with the Native American Rights Fund. I've done war crimes prosecution in former Yugoslavia War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. I mean, I've been feeling myself, but it doesn't feel like distractions from like I'm abandoning one area of work to do another. It feels like it's all connected in that by taking care of the less fortunate, by those that don't have voices, don't have representation. By taking care of them, we ultimately take care of everyone.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Claire Noon. Claire is describing her college experience assisting the war widows of Bosnia and Serbia and her recent efforts in the refugee detention centers in Texas. So you've seen, for a younger person, a lot
mm-hmm.
that people don't see in a lifetime.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
So I've thought about this a lot because, yeah, I've helped assist in a burial with a woman who they had just found her son's remains after the genocide. And
this is in Bosnia?
In Bosnia. So I've dug the dirt with her. I've sat with her while she cried. And objectively, I've also gone through the kind of floor-to-ceiling warehouses where they keep remains and seeing kind of what that looks like and kind of the worst part of humanity. But the times when I feel most helpless and when I feel most overwhelmed is when I am out of that kind of current that pulls me, when I'm just studying in a classroom separate from actual work, or when I'm unwell and I can't be present. I find that through action and through movement, it's kind of a self-healing. And also, there's these misconceptions that the fear of, oh, if genocide happens, or if detention happens, or if war happens, then there's just this blackness that takes over. And if I get near to that blackness, I will be consumed. I've found the opposite to be true. I found that when these horrible things happen, it really brings a fine tune to humanity. And people are much more present. They're much more in tune with their own strength and their own power. They are clearly focused on what matters and how to achieve it. That I have never, I mean, I have been so lucky to know the women that I know in Bosnia, and that after losing their homes, their families, everything they knew before, they still laugh, they still, you know, lift me up when I'm down. And like the children in the tent city, the eloquence with which they speak, the kind of focus with which they know what matters to them in life, is so, it like reverberates. And it feels that, yes, this is a really dark part of our existence, the things that I'm seeing and witnessing, but it's also a really defining part of our existence. And it really brings out, like, when the strength of the human spirit.
Well, you gave me two different examples. You gave me the women of Bosnia and the children in Tornio.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a story about a woman from Bosnia that illustrates your point about how war is devastating, but it doesn't kill your spirit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I worked with a group of women that had lost everything in the war and had been moved by buses when the safe zone fell. They separated the men and women. The men were killed and the women were sent on buses to the nearest Muslim territory. So they were taken to Tuzla, and that's where they remain to this day. They have not been welcomed back to the home that they had to flee. And the main woman who kind of has emerged as the leader of the group is, her name's Beba, and she was the principal in the Srebrenica schools. And so she lost a lot of family. I mean, she lost her home. It was a really horrible time, and she had to restart in a refugee camp. But the women came to her, and they said, what do we do? What do we do? Because not only do you lose everything, and war is still going on, but you are just left to kind of rot in these camps without any action, without any, you know, nothing you can tangibly do. And so she brought them together, and she said, you know what? If you can sit, you can knit. And so she got
T-shirt, huh?
Yes. If she got Oxfam, the organization, like, I don't know how she was able to communicate with them. This, like, she had no, like, she taught herself English, first of all, in the camps. She, like, figured it out in order to get some yarn donated to these women in this camp. And she did. So she They would sit together and knit, and it became a form of healing, and it became a place of community and some sort of identity. And they've been doing that for years. And so the point where I showed up in Bosnia thinking my kind of task was going to be genocide activism and kind of storytelling. And I look in this back room of the women's shelter, and it's just floor to ceiling of rugs and beautiful charape socks. And they had, there's literally no economy for non-essential goods in Bosnia. So they'd just been doing them and storing them.
Wow.
Just for the pure sense of purpose that it brought them. And I said, you guys, we can sell this and we can improve your condition. And so I've been doing that ever since. And the women, the way that they respond to purpose and to someone needing them, it's like the lights are turned back on in their eyes. It is so amazing. And they do the most amazing work, and they come together, they support each other. When I was in Bosnia, my partner actually got in a car accident, was in a coma, and they came around me in a way that, like, I've never had another person step up for me. And it felt so, I felt like, oh, I should not be the one receiving love from them. I'm here to support them. But in a moment when I really needed them, they knew exactly how to be there for someone else going through suffering.
Nobody
knew it better than them. And their ability to get up and keep going and keep improving and keep hustling, regardless of what the world has, you know, put them into, I feel like my witnessing of that light that they have inside them, I feel almost guilty for being one of the few that gets to witness it. And so that's why situations like this, when I can share that with people, that don't be afraid of the darkness, because when you're in true darkness, like, you'd surprise yourself with what you're capable of.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Claire Noon. Claire is a 30-year-old attorney who has assisted the war widows of Bosnia and Serbia and is now assisting Central American children in the refugee camps in Texas. So you told me the story of Beba.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the story from Tornillo?
So I also want to talk, Tornillo is the tent city in West Texas that houses unaccompanied children.
Right.
So children that either crossed the border with family that then were separated, or that they made the journey, they did the separation in their home countries and had to leave their families and come on their own.
And where are those home countries?
So everyone I worked with, and I think the majority of the camp, are from what's called the Northern Triangle, which is Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. And that is the place where, after, you know, civil wars in the 80s and 90s, absolutely devastated economies, devastated civil society infrastructure. The U.S. Deported mass amounts of gang members that had lived in the U.S. for many years, become part of gangs in L.A. and New York, been in prison, been trained in the gang ways, and then deported mass amounts to these small communities that in absolute devastation. And in that mix, the gangs were able to repopulate and reestablish really strong connections. And then also, when you consider that most of the cocaine grown in the world is in South America, and the biggest market is North America. So all of this huge, the channels of the drug trade are funneled through these very narrow, very small countries, and they just have no way of dealing with it. So these kids, in a lot of cases, come from small villages. They have, in some of them, they have education, some don't. But most of them are between the ages of like 10 and 18, which is the most dangerous time to be a boy. When you're over 18, I had a mother that I worked with in the Dilley Detention Facility in Southeast Texas. And she had a 10-year-old boy. And she was really adamant about the fact that she was not wanting to take anything from America. She didn't want to live here or start a family, start a life here. She really just wanted to get her son out. And then when he turned 18, they could return. When he had survived his teens, he would be able to return.
So that's the most dangerous time for kids and for particularly young men in South in Central America is
definitely
their teens.
They call the hot zone age 10 to 14.
The gang recruitment, because those are largely the ages of the gangs.
Mm-hmm. And it's also similar for women, young girls. They are either used, so the men are usually used for enforcement and transportation of the drug trade, whereas the women are used for kind of corner sales and kind of the front of the office work. So women are equally vulnerable for gang conscription. And often it's the case where you're approached by a gang, they wait outside of your school, they come to your home, bang on the door, and say, you either join us or you're against us and we will kill you. So these children and parents are aware that their chances of survival, I mean, in some cases, other brothers had been killed, in some cases, fathers, mothers. So it's not an abstract thought that this could happen to them, that a lot of these boys are faced with needing to flee or hide, go into hiding. A lot of them do go into hiding, but that's not a permanent solution. And so the families either go with them, which in many cases is impossible just because the cost of the trip now has ballooned to a point where it takes everything a family has to send one individual.
How much money do they have to raise to send someone?
So the numbers are pretty, you know... But it used to cost about $2,000 to make the journey, and that accounted for hiring a coyote to guide you and help you cross the U.S.-Mexico border, train travel, bus travel, and bribes that needed to be paid.
Extortion, right.
But that has gone up to now where the average is projected to be around $9,000. And that is because the gangs in Mexico have become so much more intentional and aware of the routes that the coyotes take and really extort them there, sometimes take everything. I had a woman that was with me in the Dili detention facility that had been left in the middle of Mexico with her 10-year-old daughter without anything, and she had to begin work there for a couple months before she could. And the kind of work, she didn't really go into detail, but it was my understanding that it was very difficult, possibly sex trafficking work.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with Claire Noon. Claire is a local civil rights attorney who's been assisting the women and children of Central America, often referred to these days as the Northern Triangle. These folks have been seeking asylum in the United States and are being detained in refugee centers in Texas.
There really is no safe future for children in the Northern Triangle. It's been called the most dangerous place in the world that is not an active war zone. The highest murder rate in the world jumps between Honduras and El Salvador every year. Some of the stories, though, the children and the mothers across the board have a genuine and heartfelt hope that the worst is over. And some kids, when they make it to the U.S. and are taken into custody of Office of Refugee Resettlement and put in these detention facilities, they are relieved. They have food, they have a roof over their head, even if they don't have blankets. And they are not being shot at. So their kind of perspective is, okay, this might be bad, but it's not as bad as where I'm coming from. And I think that that's what the Trump administration really underestimates, is the push factors, what's pushing these people to leave their homes. I mean, if you just think, what would it take you to leave your home, to leave your community of Glenwood Springs, to leave the English language, to leave the food you like, to leave your animals, like all of that. I mean, it's amazing to hear of what they actually went through just to leave home and then to make the journey. And then to think a little bit of tear gas or a 25-foot wall, that's really going to make you get there and go, "Nah, you know what? This isn't worth it. Let's go back." That like severely underestimates the struggle that these people are facing where they came from. I had one woman who 8 of her brothers had been murdered. She was the only sibling remaining.
Wow.
8. And that came out way after. I mean, through the interview, I'm kind of walking through her story and it's compelling and everything. And then I said, "Okay, so tell me about your family." And she's like, "Well, I used to have family." I was like, "Okay, tell me about that." She said, "Well, my father was killed, 8 of my brothers, and my mother passed." And it's like, holy cow. Like, I can't, like, the death of a sibling.
How old was she?
She was about 35, and she came with a young daughter. And it was very apparent she left children behind. It was very difficult for her. But the young daughter was the one that was in the most direct threat. And so she had to flee with that child. In a lot of cases that I met parents, they had come with their sons that were in the hot zone or children that had been witness to murders and had to leave, you know, the younger ones, because yes, the younger one might need its mother more, but it is not in direct threat of being murdered. So the kind of rationale, like, okay, why didn't you bring your youngest kid? That makes sense. It's a totally different kind of problem-solving thing. Like, okay, how do I literally make this child survive?
Well, and again, from our vantage point, we make judgment about why they would leave the rest of their family mm-hmm. there. Why did this woman come with just one of her children?
Right.
But when you know the backstory,
yeah,
you know, and she couldn't bring the whole family, and she had to get out of there with
the most vulnerable, the one receiving the direct gang threats, the one who had a gun pointed in her head at school, like the one that literally, if you do not take them, they will be killed.
Do you hear reverberations from your Bosnian experience?
Definitely. I mean, it is one of the common threads of humanity that violence comes into the lives of civilians, people that do not seek it, people that do not embrace it, people that would rather live peaceful lives with their families, working good, honest jobs, and, you know, just being good people. That even when you do, you know, follow the rules, when you are good to people, when you go to church, when you don't try to make too much of a fuss, even those people are faced with, when war comes, when violence comes into your town, there's no protection. There is no discrimination. It comes to everybody. And hearing the stories of women holding children and old mothers, and that happens in Bosnia during the breakup of former Yugoslavia, and that happens in El Salvador in 2018. There is no, when someone else has a gun and they're holding it against you, threatening your family, all other differences go away. We are all so similar. We all handle it exactly the same way. And that is to get into protection mode, to get into survival mode, and to do whatever it takes to make those happen. America's a complicated and difficult place, but I am so proud to be a citizen of a nation where people in trouble run to us. Regardless of our foreign policy, of our gun violence, of like anything, or regardless of all of that, we are the place that people seek for refuge in a storm. And that I take that very seriously as a citizen, and that I want to uphold that incredible honor that tradition has brought to us. And so it's still very alive and well. People, this one little boy walking on foot by himself, both of his parents had been murdered, walking on foot, and he did not speak a lick of English, was just following group from group of kind of older boys, and they'd kind of protect him. They're very good to each other. It's so encouraging that even children, you know, even at the elementary school, they're going to be bullies, and they're so good to each other. And they really look out for each other, and they took him under his wing. And somebody along the way taught him the Pledge of Allegiance in English. And he was able to,
wow.
We were speaking Spanish, you know, And as he was starting to talk, you could tell that he knew the feeling and he knew what it meant. But as far as where one word started and one word ended, you know, like when you sing a song or something right. in French and you're like, really don't. But he did it perfectly first way through. And I said, my goodness, I don't know if many U.S. citizens or even politicians know that. But he was like, this is where I want to plant my flag. I want to add to this society. I want to add to this economy, this country. I want to be one of the, you know, strengths.
That was Claire Noon. On January 7th, 2019, Claire learned from her legal team that the Tornillo detention camp was closing. 3 days later, she flew to Brownsville, Texas to join them as they assist the children who are being moved from Tornillo Detention Center to a repurposed Walmart called Casa Padre, which loosely translates into English as My Father's House. You've been listening to the Immigrant Stories program. For more on immigrant stories, please go to our website, immigrantstories.net. Thanks for listening.